I'm going to begin with a question. And the question is this: who doesn't need friends? To pose that question is to beg the obvious, because the need for friendship is so firmly ingrained in human nature. The young need friends, and so do the elderly. The poor need friends, as do the prosperous. Ordinary people like you and I need friends, and so do celebrities. People in positions of power, they need friends too, as do the rest of us. So to rephrase my original question, who needs friends? You in the back row, stand up, raise your hand if you need a friend, brother. That's it. All right. Of course, the answer is everybody needs a friend. And it may be said that a life of wealth without friends would be a sad and lonely existence. But a life filled with the laughter and love of dear friends would be a life that is rich indeed, irrespective of one's financial condition. And I think that this, throughout the ages, has been one of those enduring truths of human existence. But what exactly is friendship? And who can define it? Ask 10 people, and you will likely get 10 answers. Similar, perhaps, but not exactly the same. Even Plato, in his dialogue on friendship, Lysis, does not provide us with a conclusive definition. The English writer Hugh Kingsmill once amusingly referred to friends as God's apology. God's apology. What did he mean by that? Well, he meant that by allowing us to choose our friends, God was making amends for our families. So, what is a friend? Most of us would say that a friend is different from an acquaintance. But that doesn't get us very far, does it? And when it comes to friends, we talk of close friends, old friends, out-of-town friends, professional friends, male, female friends, even fair-weather friends, and sometimes high-maintenance friends. Do you have any of those? In regard to that latter category, the English humorist Oscar Wilde once said this of a certain individual: he has no enemies, but he is intensely disliked by his friends. To add to the confusion, we might consider whether the nature of friendship has changed in recent times. By recent times, I mean in the last 10 or 20 years. For example, has the nature of friendship been permanently altered by the internet and social media? And will traditional friends that I spoke of earlier, will those eventually be replaced by the new virtual friend? I don't pretend to know the answers to these questions, but I do suggest that we start our inquiry by looking at what some of the great intellects have said on the subject. And with friendship being such an essential part of human happiness, you would think that there would be an abundance of literature on the subject, but oddly enough, there isn't. But there are some thoughtful essays, which I found and located, and from which I will draw in tonight's lecture. And as the title of my talk would indicate, we're going to begin with Aristotle. Why Aristotle, you might ask? I'll tell you why. Because Aristotle, more than most thinkers, had a profound and lasting influence on Western culture. That single man shaped and molded to a large degree what Western culture is today by his writings, by his deep penetrating thoughts. And he did, along with that, he did write a treatise on friendship, about 25 pages or so. And that short treatise, even today, after 2,300 years, still bears examination. Now, everybody has heard of Aristotle, but not everybody knows much about him. So, with your indulgence, please allow me to give a very brief introduction. Aristotle lived in the 4th century BC in Greece. He was Plato's most famous pupil, with whom he studied for years, 15 or 20 years, I forget exactly how long. And later, Aristotle became a personal mentor to Alexander, the son of Philip of Macedonia. This was before Alexander became Alexander the Great, known for his military conquests. But as a young boy, Alexander studied with Aristotle for a number of years. Now, his writings, and these are what have shaped Western culture, had a profound impact on it. They cover a wide field of disciplines. And it's one thing for a person to be learned in one field, but listen to all these disciplines that he talked about and wrote about: biology, government, philosophy, politics, logic, rhetoric, and more. And on the topic of friendship, which is our subject this evening, he said this, interesting statement. He said that a person who took delight in solitude, a person who did not feel the need for human companionship, was either a wild beast or a god. I don't think we have any of the former here, but I won't speculate on the latter. So Aristotle's statement might be a slight exaggeration, but he really has a point. For you and I are social creatures. We are social creatures, and very few of us could do without human contact for an extended period of time without suffering severe psychological damage. Now, let's imagine that if Aristotle had gone to the Oracle of Delphi in ancient Greece to ask her a question. Many people often went to the Oracle. Military commanders went to her. Leaders of state went to her to ask for advice. But let's imagine that Aristotle went to the Oracle and said, "Oracle, I'd like you to look far into the future. I'm really curious to know what the world will look like in the 21st century. Had she been able to tell him, I think he would have been amazed by many things, but especially by today's internet technology, which has brought us a host of social networking sites, thereby making it easier than ever before to have more and more friends. Take Facebook, for example, which I'll be referring to tonight. And by the way, when I mention Facebook, I'll be using that as sort of a stand-in for all social media grouped together. Do any of you know how many users Facebook currently has? Take a guess. It's a lot.
2 billion?
2 billion? Not quite. Last October, it passed the 1 billion mark. That's a lot of people. That's a lot of friends. Now, let's imagine you and I going back in time to a time before the internet, before computers, before the cell phone, even before the telephone and the telegraph. How did friends communicate in those olden days? Let's say, for example, you were living in 16th century France or Germany. How would you stay in touch with your friends? Well, that's easy. The way most people did it back then was they got together and talked in churches, in homes, in parlors, in the marketplace. They talked face to face, eyeball to eyeball. Now, if your friend lived far away, what would you do? There was no telephone or telegraph yet. They wrote letters. Of course, it took longer in those days for communications to get through. But there was an advantage, I think, that we've lost now. Back then, when people wrote letters, it was very often a work of art. It was an expression of their personal self. The handwriting would reveal personal characteristics, which a graphologist could tell you. And people took pride in their penmanship and their writing. And so we have lost some of that, and I hear today they're not even teaching cursive in the schools anymore. But fortunately, people still talk to one another today. But you have to wonder if our reliance on technology is causing us to lose some of the skills that go into making artful conversation. You have to wonder if we are not sacrificing quality for quantity or thoughtfulness for speed. Today, instead of talking face to face, and this is especially true of high schoolers, young people, very true, we resort more and more to textings or posting on social media sites. I'll refer to a book a little bit later by a clinical psychologist, and she did many studies, and she says very often in high school, the students are passing one another in a hallway, and somebody will say, "Hey, Joe, I need to talk to you. Text me, don't talk to me, text me." Well, as I said, we resort more and more to this type of communication. And the good thing is this enables us to stay in touch with a greater number of people than was possible 20 or 30 years ago. No doubt about it, that's an advantage. And we can do it much more quickly. But as one writer recently pointed out in the Wall Street Journal, texting is all about speed and convenience. It's about making brief comments. It's about getting quick answers. Okay, that may be a good thing. I mean, we're all busy, and we appreciate the efficiency that this technology brings. That's why it's being used. But here's the problem. What happens if all or most of our communications take this form? As the Wall Street Journal writer pointed out, and I quote, "In all this hurry, there isn't time to explore emotions. And the end result is often a deep-seated feeling of loneliness." A deep-seated feeling of loneliness. And here's another thing. Are all those people on our Facebook page really our friends? I mean, come on. Or is the Facebook friend just a clever marketing euphemism which we apply indiscriminately to all those who fall within our ever-expanding circle of contacts? You know, sometimes you hear people boasting that they have 100 or 200 friends on Facebook. There was somebody on staff a few years ago that once brought me into his office and said, "Look, David, I have 467 friends." Again, that may be a good thing or not. As social psychologists have recently discovered, there is a profound sense of loneliness among people who spend inordinate amounts of time on social media sites. The apparent irony is this: how can you be lonely when you have 200 friends? In her book, Alone Together, clinical psychologist Sherry Turkle says, and I quote, "Research portrays Americans as increasingly insecure, isolated, and lonely. We expect more from technology and less from each other," end quote. Now, when I mentioned the apparent irony of increasing loneliness despite having an abundance of Facebook friends, I chose the word apparent with deliberation. Because any intelligent person, upon reflection, will realize that all those contacts, all those scores and dozens of contacts on our Facebook or other social media sites do not constitute true friends. Okay, some of them may be, but not all. In fact, I would venture to say not most of them. In light of all this, I'd ask you to consider that despite its many obvious benefits, social networking technology has a potential downside. You don't hear people talk about this as often as they talk about the upside. If something has an upside, there's usually a downside. I'm going to give you three concerns. Number one, a watering down, a dilution of traditional friendship to a fragmented relationship of convenience. Number two, a blurring of the lines between casual acquaintances and real friends. And number three, an erosion of the virtues that traditionally have made friendship something special, to be replaced by the trivial, the artificial, and the superficial. So as a result, I think some people, in fact, I think many people have deluded themselves into thinking that they have more friends than they really do. They're confused. They have confused quantity with quality. They've confused popularity with durability. A true friend is with you through thick and thin. Popularity is ephemeral that comes and goes. And they've confused grandstanding, making statements for the world, with intimacy. Real friends can have intimate conversations, but blabbing everything on your wall for hundreds of people to see, that's a far cry from intimate conversation. So therefore, I think it's time to revisit the idea of what constitutes a real friend. And I could think of no better way of doing this than to revisit the writings of Aristotle. Now, Aristotle, as I said, wrote a detailed treatise on friendship, and it's found in his Nicomachean Ethics, sometimes referred to as the Ethics for short. It's about 25, 30 pages, and as I said earlier, the fact that this is still read today, some 2,300 years later, is a testament to this man's enduring insights into human nature. Now, one of his first observations is, friendship is a necessity. Unless one is a god or a wild beast, one is going to be in need of friends. And according to Aristotle, friends are needed for different reasons. Example, the young, they need friends to guide them and help them from making mistakes in life. The elderly need friends to help them with things that they can no longer do for themselves due to frailty or illness or just lack of energy. The poor or people without means, they need friends to help them with assistance and as a refuge from their troubles. And even those who are prosperous, those who are well off, they need friends too with whom they can share their prosperity. And finally, people in positions of power and influence, they need friends, number one, to help protect their privileged status, and number two, they also enjoy bestowing favors on their friends and family. Let's move away from Aristotle for the moment. We'll come back to him. Another prominent writer from antiquity was Cicero. Cicero was a Roman. He was also a statesman, but we remember him today primarily for his writings, his essays, his dialogues. 300 years after Aristotle wrote his treatise on friendship, Cicero wrote an essay entitled De Amicitia, De Amicitia, meaning on friendship. In that essay, he took the thoughts of Aristotle and expanded on them further. And one little nugget of wisdom that I gleaned from his essay is that, with the exception of wisdom, and Cicero placed a high premium on wisdom, he constantly is talking about that, as do many of the philosophers of old. With the exception of wisdom, the greatest of all possible gifts was friendship. Now let's fast forward a little bit. Let's go to the Renaissance in Europe. 1,500 years later, the English Renaissance writer Francis Bacon said this. He also wrote an essay on friendship, and I quote, "When we share our joys with our friends, we rejoice all the more. And when we share our troubles with our friends, the burden becomes less. The joys increase, the troubles become lighter." At about the same time that Francis Bacon wrote that, there was a French philosopher, Montaigne, who also wrote a very good essay on friendship. And he noted, quote, "Our free will has no product more properly its own than affection and friendship," end quote. In other words, one of the most important functions of our ability to choose is to choose our friends. So, what constitutes friendship? Let's get to the nuts and bolts. Aristotle listed two basic qualifications. Number one, friends must be well disposed towards each other. In other words, there must be mutual goodwill, both ways. Number two, This feeling, this mutual goodwill, must be recognized and returned. This is the principle of reciprocity. It can't be a one-way street. If one person extends kindness and affection and the other one does not respond, that is not a friendship. It might be something else. It might be a fan club, but it's not a friendship. Aristotle pointed out that sometimes people confuse a feeling of goodwill with friendship. For example, we can have a feeling of goodwill for people we don't personally know, but whom we might admire or respect from a distance. Or we might confuse friendliness with friendship. For example, some of you may project an aura of congeniality in all your social interactions. You just can't help it. You have a sunny disposition, you're upbeat, you're just naturally that way. But mere goodwill and congeniality, unfortunately, do not constitute friendship, and people get confused. Those qualities, however, may lay the basis for building a friendship, but by themselves, it's not a friendship, not yet. Let's talk about Cicero. He added one more qualification for friendship: the willingness to give and receive advice. Now, everybody likes to give advice. Makes you feel important. But how many of us enjoy receiving advice, especially if it's of a critical nature? Not too many. But if there is that mutual goodwill between two people, as Aristotle stipulated, then such an exchange of advice is possible and no hard feelings are taken. Now, being the astute observer of human nature that he was, Aristotle listed three basic types of friendship. These are three basic categories, and they still hold true today. Number one, friendships based on utility. Number two, friendships based on pleasure. And number three, those based on goodness. Now, I'll talk of each in turn. Let's start with the first one, friendships of utility. What is that? These are the types of relationships where each party hopes to gain something from the other. It's a case of quid pro quo. They're often based on business or professional relationships. And in friendships of this type, the people involved tend not to spend a whole lot of time together. In fact, they may not even like each other all that much, but their relationship serves a purpose because both parties benefit in some way. And even if they do have a warm and fuzzy feeling towards each other, even if that does exist, these kinds of friendships are often temporary and come to an end when that relationship no longer serves one or the other. For example, I'll give you a personal example. As you heard earlier, I used to work in electronics, the distribution of industrial components. And we had a number of manufacturers that we represented, and their sales reps would call on us at the office. They'd give us sales presentations on their newest product, provide lunch for us. They'd take the boss maybe out to go golfing, or some of the outside sales guys who called on the same customers. And that was all well and good. But if our company decided for some reason to drop their product line, that relationship came to an end very quickly. And another characteristic of utility friendships, they easily give way to complaints. If either party thinks it's not getting what it deserves, there's a problem. And we saw this with our sales reps. If we didn't push their line enough and their sales numbers were dropping, they had a problem with that, and they usually let us know. And if we, for example, added to our line card another manufacturer who competed directly with them, they really had a problem with that. So Aristotle would call these types of friendship accidental or incidental because those involved are not loved and appreciated for their actual qualities of character, but for whatever benefit each party derives. Montaigne, the French philosopher, echoed this view. He said, quote, "What we ordinarily call friendships are nothing but acquaintances and familiarities which are formed by chance or convenience." Another philosopher from the Roman days, Seneca, He lived about 100 years after Cicero. He called these fair weather friendships. Fair weather friendships. Quote, and this is Seneca, "This explains the crowd of friends that clusters about successful people and the lonely atmosphere about the ruined, their friends running away when it comes to the testing point," end quote. And you all know that if you won the lottery tomorrow, you're going to have more friends than you ever anticipated. They're going to come out of the woodworks. But when that money's gone, those friends are gone too. You can count on that. On a lighter note, thinking of fair weather friendships, the Chicago writer Joseph Epstein, in his book Friendship and Exposé, he speaks fondly of his foul weather friend. Not fair weather friend, but his foul weather friend. What he meant by that is that he had this one friend, and the only time they could get together to go out for coffee was when it was either raining or snowing or inclement weather, because his friend was addicted to playing golf. He could never get together with him unless the weather was bad. All right, the philosopher Seneca also talked about the temporary nature of friendships, not grounded in anything beyond convenience. And here's a little pithy quote from one of his letters. "The ending inevitably matches the beginning." He's talking about friendships of utility. "The ending matches the beginning. A person who begins to be your friend because it pays will similarly cease to be friends because it pays him to do so." So that's the first category. We have two more. Second category, friendships based on pleasure. Now, Aristotle ranks this category a little bit higher than the first category. This is very common. Aristotle points out that friendships formed between young people are generally of this type because their feelings, their lives are largely regulated by their feelings. And because feelings are prone to change, these types of friendships are often ephemeral and short-lived. But it's not only young people that have this type of friendship. Adults do too. Some examples might be your tennis partner, your fishing buddy, the members of your local hiking club, the guys you play poker with on Friday nights. And I have to say, there's nothing wrong with these relationships, for we all need time to break away and have fun and relaxation. Nothing at all wrong with them. But we should remember their nature, that they can sometimes come quickly to an end when one party or the other no longer derives something from that relationship. Example, if you had a person you went out to play tennis with, your whole friendship is based on playing tennis. And you might go out for a bite to eat after tennis, but that's really what your whole relationship revolves around. And that person suddenly has a severe injury and they can't play tennis anymore. What do you think is going to happen to that friendship? Now, the third category, which Aristotle holds in the highest esteem, are friendships based on goodness. This, according to Aristotle, is the ideal type of friendship. It's not based on utility, it's not based on pleasure, but on mutual goodness. And by goodness, he's referring to qualities of character that are admirable, qualities such as courage, compassion, loyalty, sympathy, those type of qualities in both parties. Now, friendships of this type tend to last a very long time. As theosophists, we might say lifetimes. And this is the type that Cicero was talking about when he referred to friendships as the greatest of all possible gifts. But let's get real. Realistically, is it even possible in this day and age to find a friendship that lives up to this almost impossible ideal set forth by philosophers such as Emerson, Montaigne, and Aristotle? In this increasingly fragmented world, is such a friendship possible? Is it realistic? Perhaps the best we can hope for are those specialized but limited types of friendship, like your workout partner at the gym, or a coworker with whom you occasionally go out to lunch, your friend on the softball team, or your neighbor from the local PTA. Maybe a friendship based on these noble qualities of characters is no longer feasible in these fast-paced times that we live in. But this much is certain. This much I know. You cannot create a friend simply by adding another contact to your Facebook page. You cannot maintain and nurture a friendship simply by texting at your convenience and then expecting the other person to drop everything and respond immediately. And you cannot develop intimacy and trust when your every casual remark is posted online to be read by scores of people. But why is this? Why can't we simply use modern technology to have all the friends we want? I mean, we depend on technology to solve all our other problems, or at least some people think that. Well, Aristotle has already given us the answer. It takes time to develop trust. It takes time to really get to know a person, to get beyond that surface facade, which is so often what people project in social media sites. That's not the real, that's an image that they want people to view them as. Research has been done on this, a lot of research. And as clinical psychologist Sherry Turkle says in her book, which I referred to earlier, Alone Together, Why We Expect More from Technology and Less from Each Other, and here's the quote, the ties we form through the internet are not, in the end, the ties that bind, but they are the ties that preoccupy. Yeah, they keep us busy. Keep us busy. Remember Aristotle's two basic qualifications of friendship? Number one, mutual goodwill. Number two, reciprocity. Without either of these two, you don't have a friendship. It may be something else. It may look like a friendship. It may smell like a friendship, but it ain't a friendship. And another thing, true friendship in that third category, it touches us deeply in our soul, in the heart of our being. It goes beyond that surface facade and really arouses something from deep within us. Khalil Gibran says this in his famous book, The Prophet, quote, let there be no purpose in friendship save the deepening of the spirit, end quote. Well, that may be, as I said, too high of an ideal for most of us, or not. And I want to repeat that there's nothing wrong with those friendships based on utility, nor is there anything wrong with those based on pleasure. Chances are, everyone in this room has many relationships that fall into those two categories. But while these are useful and necessary, they don't touch us in the core of our being. They're superficial. They're ephemeral. And there's another problem. Sometimes problems occur when we confuse these secondary types of friendships with those based on goodness. People get confused. This often happens when one or the other fails to remember or forgets the basis of their friendship, utility or pleasure. Aristotle said that most quarrels with friends arise when this happens. And sometimes, unfortunately, it occurs when one person deliberately misrepresents their motives to another. Comparing this higher type of friendship with the other secondary types, Montaigne said, quote, let not these other common friendships be placed in this rank. Further, he said, I advise you not to confuse the rules of the two. You must walk in those other friendships, bridle in hand, with prudence and caution. The knot is not so well tied that there is no cause to mistrust it. I'd like to end this talk with a question raised by Aristotle in his Ethics. And that question was, what is the optimum number of friends one should have? Very apropos in these days, I would say. The way he answered that is he addressed it towards each of those three categories. And here's what he said. For the utilitarian type of friends, some are necessary, but not too many. He was realistic. He knew we had to have some friendships of that type, but not too many, because life is too short for us to be obligated to return favors to a large number of people. We just don't have the time. Second category, friendships based on pleasure. Again, he said, a few are generally sufficient, just, and I like this, just like a pinch of seasoning in our food. Those are his words. And finally, the last category, friendship based on goodness, on character. Because of the requirements of time and intimacy, there is a limit. Generally, a small circle of intimate friends is sufficient. So in this case, you have an example of less being more. So in conclusion, as you and I make use of today's internet technology, please let us not mistake the virtual friend for the genuine article. Though we may find it helpful to use social media sites to network with others for reasons of job or career, or while we may find it convenient and efficient to stay in touch with family and other acquaintances through this technology, if we are looking for something of value, something timeless, something more precious than any gift, then, in the end, all we need is a few good friends. Thank you. We have a few minutes if somebody has a question or a comment or observation. Tim.
In the way Aristotle considered it, did he have any sort of category that might speak about, in Buddhism they have that category of the spiritual friend, or would the spiritual teachers or things like that fall into that category of friends based on goodness, or? I'm just wondering if that was a category he had for that.
He doesn't specify that in those words. He doesn't even use the word spiritual, at least in the translation I had. But that would probably be analogous to that third category, I would imagine. Well, on the other hand, when you go to a teacher, and I'm not talking a spiritual guru now, when you go to any teacher or instructor, there's a mutual exchange there. The student wants to get knowledge, and the teacher is usually paid, either financially or in terms of respect or some other form. So that might be one of utility. And when the lessons are over, there may be a parting of the ways. But it could also transform into that third type. Yes, sir.
I believe when Jesus went around doing his preaching, when Jesus went around doing his preaching, he had 12 disciples, 12 apostles rather, and those were his closest friends, and he got by through a lifetime with just 12. There were others, you know, there were peripheral type people, the disciples they call them, but he put all of his time and effort with these 12.
Mm-hmm. This idea of Aristotle of friendship based on goodness, when you know what he meant by that, I think realistically today you'll be very fortunate if you have even a few that fall into that category. For one thing, the world is going much faster now. People are much more busy, or at least it seems that way. And so because of time constraints, the possibility of having many of those friends, I just don't think it's feasible. You probably can have considerably more friends in those other categories, but still not too many, as for reasons that I gave earlier.
Well, first of all, thank you very much for the wonderful and inspiring lecture. I think I will copy and distribute it to all my friends. For sure, no kidding.
All 200 of them?
No, I have no Facebook account, by the way. just kidding. I just wanted to ask a question. Why do you think that those people who have no many friends have no many friends? What impedes us from building this genuine friendship?
Well, there could be several answers to that, but the most direct answer would be go back to the definition. Both friends have to have, there has to be a mutual goodness. So Aristotle says A good man cannot be this kind of friends with a bad man, because that person lacks those qualities of trust, generosity, courage. Those two cannot be friends. They might be acquaintances, but they, according to his definition, they can never be friends. They can only be friends if this person acquires those qualities, and then they're meeting, so to speak, on the same level.
Any more questions? You do have.
Oh, yeah, well, just, you know, going along to what she said, I've tried to do that with people. I've tried to be nice, and I've tried to, you know, really trust someone. And then in the end of the relationship, whatever it was, I realized that the other person, you know, they didn't have the capability to trust me at all. And so, you know, I noticed that. And it kind of goes along with what I was going to ask. Have you ever noticed that... like the status of your friends changing? Like maybe if, you know, like you're really, really close friends with somebody for maybe a couple years, and then something changes in their life, and then they turn into a friend of utility rather than, you know, a friend uh-huh. who's just
I'm a little bit older than you, so I've had a chance. I have the advantage of a greater perspective of years, you know. And the first thing that came to mind is I had a lot of what I thought were really good friends in high school. But later I went to Boston, Berklee School of Music, then after that the Army, and I broke away from those friends. And then years later, I had occasion to hook up with some of them, and we got together, and it just wasn't the same because we had changed. We had gone in different directions. So those things often change.
Thank you. Appreciate that.
But, you know, it's not something... When you fail, when you look at somebody and hope that you have a chance of being that kind of friend and it doesn't work out, you shouldn't let that discourage you, because sooner or later, another person will come along and it might just be the right one.
I think your observations are very astute and very valuable. I'm seeing an erosion in our culture. And it's not just social media. It's visiting, supposedly, when the television's on across the room. It's very hard to focus. And I think when I get home tonight, I've got a couple of letters that I'm going to put them in the mail. But one of the examples of this, with the recent flooding, what happened, I live in Lombard. There was no response, no call for friends and neighbors to come help. The village would come and dump a pile of sand at your house and give you as many sandbags as you wanted. Mm-hmm. There's a difference. There's an erosion there. The flood back in 87, the whole community was out helping each other. And I'm wondering if that's an extension of the social media that and this noise and this all this media pollution going on that's interfering with our ability to relate to each other.
Mm-hmm. That's a good comment. And now, just so you don't misunderstand me, I am not bashing or denigrating social media. And it's here to stay. It's not going away. But I do think that it tends to have this effect. I quoted a clinical psychologist who wrote that book, Alone Together. She did a lot of research on this, and others have as well. I think it is causing us to become more fragmented in the way we relate to others. And particularly with people that are maybe shy or have trouble socializing to begin with, it can be a bad thing because they just hole up in their basement or their room and they live on their computer. And come on, let's face it. Sitting down, you and I, sitting in a restaurant, in a booth, having coffee and a donut, looking at each other, being able to catch the inflections in the voice, the body language, the smile or the frown, all those little things go into making artful conversation. But when you do it, I know you have Skype, you could do it, but when you're just texting or posting things, you lose an awful lot. And those things are valuable, they serve a purpose, but if you think that they can replace this traditional time-honored method where people get together and share quiet time together, mm-mm. I recall being at Panera's last year. My wife and I went in to have a snack, and right across from us was a booth, two young women, probably early 30s, late 20s. They sat down with their beverage and their snack, and both of them had their iPods out. And so there was some conversation going back and forth, but I was looking. A lot of times they weren't even looking at each other. Their eyes were glued to this machine. What was coming up on that machine was more important than what this friend was saying. You know, and this is what I see. I mean, you see, I heard a story, and this is in the newspapers, New York. New York, you ever been to New York? In Manhattan, there are lots of people there on the sidewalks, even late at night. And there are increasing incidents of people walking amongst the crowds, their eyes are glued to their phones, and they step into potholes or they trip off curbs because they're not paying attention. They're not being mindful. They're being distracted. And let's face it, a lot of that stuff is trivial, superficial, artificial stuff. It's not of any great importance. You can live without it. But people are increasingly fascinated by this technology. And I think people will at some point learn to step back and use it properly. But so many people are just getting sucked up into it. And it's controlling them instead of them controlling the machine. If you control it, that's fine. But if the machine is controlling you, if it becomes an obsession, if it becomes an addiction, buddy, you got a problem. You got a real problem. And unfortunately, there's a lot of people like that in our society today. Hold up in their basement or in the attic or wherever, and they're living in this virtual reality. And on the other end, somewhere in cyberspace, there's another person living in their imaginary world. And they each are talking to each other, and they have no clue as to who the other person is, but they have this imaginary idea based on this facade that each one of them is projecting. Yes, sir. Nothing needs to be done about Facebook. I think people just... I'm not a big fan of government interference and more regulations. I think we have far too much of that already. But what I do encourage is people to take control of their own lives, to be more aware of making their decisions, and use these things wisely. Let me ask you, what can the government do besides putting restrictions? That'll never happen.
They could do it.
They could, but it will never happen.
If it was wartime, they would do it.
Yeah. Well, realistically, that ain't going to happen. You know it. I know it. People, it's just like when Alexander Graham Bell invented the telephone. People had to get used to that. They had to live with it. Now we have personal computers. People learn to live with it. When a new technology comes, can anybody give me an example of a new technology that suddenly faded? Unless it was replaced by a more up-to-date technology? Offhand, I can't think of any. So the best way, yes, there are things we don't like about the technology, but I think our best protection is to be aware of those, if we have kids, to make them aware of it, and to use them wisely. Use our freedom of choice instead of relying on some bureaucrat in the government to do it for us. Make our decisions, you know, tell our kids what the dangers are. Don't rely on some faceless bureaucrat in the state capitol. They don't care. They don't care about you. They don't know you. They're just doing a job to get a paycheck. Stuff like that, do it yourself. That's my opinion. I could be wrong, though.
No.
Yes.
Anyways, it seems like we are addressing or more or less talking about the adolescence age, you know, how we introduce this technology to our children. But also another thing that I think that is a barrier for adolescents, not only the internet, but their interrelationship. It seems like when they go out, I don't know how many things they share. Most of the things that they do nowadays is drinking, going out partying, doing drugs. Mm-hmm. Perhaps I am entering into a different arena, a little bit more sensitive. I don't know if you would like to get into it, but What would be your recommendation for these adolescents, and I'm very close to that age still, that could relate to one another, you know, that they could build some more humane relationship mm-hmm. beyond these bad habits?
Well,
or you know.
In response to that, I will say vices. That when I, many years ago when I was in high school, there were kids went out and drank. They got drunk on weekends. They did all those things. They drag raced their cars up and down the strip. You know, they did all those foolish things. We didn't have computers then. But I would just, if I was a parent, and if I was a younger and I had a child, let's say 10, 12 years of age, maybe a little older, I would try to make them aware of some of the downside and try to have them use discrimination as to how they use these tools. In Sherry Turkle's book, there are some wonderful examples, but she says, kids now, this is becoming more and more common in high school, you know, boyfriend and girlfriend, and they break up. You know, in my day, you would write a letter, say, or you'd tell through a friend, tell her I don't want to see her anymore or whatever. Now they do it by texting. Imagine that, being dumped by text. Person doesn't even have the common courtesy or courage to step up and say, Mary, it's just not working anymore. Send a text. It's a coward's way to do it. It's doing it on the cheap. And what does that say about you if you dump your girlfriend with a text in the dead of night when everybody's asleep, 2:00 in the morning? I'm going to dump her. And then quick, turn that phone off. Turn that phone off so you don't have to talk to her in live. Yeah. See, the internet. The internet and this technology is very great, but it is an enabler for bad behavior. In many ways, it enables bad behavior. You know, for example, not to veer off, well, I am veering off a little bit, but bloggers, you know, we have, everybody's a blogger these days. People say the most reprehensible things about other people on blogs because they can do it anonymously. They wouldn't have the guts to do that if they stuck their real name to it and posted it in a magazine. And furthermore, the magazine probably wouldn't publish half of those because they're full of profanity and childish, you know, remarks. So they do it under a pseudonym, anonymously. That's bad. You know, that's a bad habit to get into. It erodes your character, your integrity. And you see a lot of that now. So that's what I would talk to my kids about. But it's not only kids. It's people.
Everyone.
Yeah. Yeah, it's all over. On the other hand.
You know, being involved with the Theosophical Society, you, of course, you know, you have someone like an... Yesterday was White Lotus Day, celebrating the passing of H.P. Blavatsky. And the way that she lived in front of a writing pad and wrote countless you know, mm-hmm. pages of things that became quite popularized during her time. Mm-hmm. I just, you know, you just kind of speculate, what could she have done? I mean, if in fact there was an internet.
Incredible.
And wow. The sort of linkages that are happening now into those people who are trying to pursue that, where, you know, today, in conversation with someone in the Philippines mm-hmm. about trying to promote something that is actually about elevating consciousness mm-hmm. through the internet.
Yeah, yeah. No question about it. Again, during most of this talk, I emphasized the downside. There is an upside. But I didn't spend much time on that because I figured you all know what the upside is. People don't talk about the downside, so that's why I wanted to talk about that, because it's been ignored largely. But no question, the internet and word processors has increased productivity at all levels, productivity of all types. Now, Blavatsky, who knows how many more books she would have written had she had access to a word processor or the internet. But thinking about that, there's a downside to that too. One of the marvelous things about the secret doctrine is it has these hundreds and hundreds of obscure references. People just marveled, how did she get that? Because she only had a small traveling library of 6 or 8 books. Well, if she was able to do Google searches or Bing searches, it wouldn't be that remarkable. People would say, she looked it up online. Anybody can, any jamoke can look it up online. Any schmuck can write that book. They got a darn computer. That's nothing special. It just takes a little time. But see, you see what I'm saying here? You can twist it that way too.